Soon after I first heard about this workshop, I by chance looked at a particular blog which made the statement that quantum gravity could not be experimental. And I got very irritated by that posting. And so I'm actually going to try to persuade you that we are already doing experimental quantum gravity, although maybe not experimental in the traditional sense, but observational quantum gravity. So that's going to be my main theme. So I will have the following outline. I'll start with a very brief motivation. I'm talking about cosmology. And the first part of the talk will be talking about backgrounds for cosmology. Then most of the data involving cosmology is data on fluctuations, microwave anisotropies and large-scale structure. So the third part of the talk will be how we can use fluctuations in principle to probe Planck-scale physics. Then I'll have some concrete examples. And the first example will be emergence of fluctuations from a tachyonic Big Bang. And then the second application is going to be fluctuations in string gas cosmology. And then the last part of the talk is going to be detecting cosmic superstrings in the CMB. So this is a rough outline of the talk. This part is going to be fairly general. Good. So I already mentioned the main theme of my motivation, but let me reiterate it in a different way. So when you talk about experimental quantum gravity, there are two things that you could have in mind. One thing is you could ask, is there a smoking gun for quantum gravity which we could find in a laboratory? So this is not what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about seeing trails of a smoking gun in the sky. Now, obviously, if we see trails of a smoking gun, we cannot for sure tell who the perpetrator of the crime is. So it's going to make the investigation a little bit more difficult. However, it's also going to make the investigation a little bit more interesting. So it is in this sense that I think we can do observational quantum gravity. We will not see the smoking guns in the laboratory, but we will see trails. And we will have to learn how to interpret these trails. So that's the theme. So let me now turn to background cosmology. So most people believe that the universe has gone through a period of inflation. So I want to ask the question about observational quantum gravity first for inflationary cosmology. So inflationary cosmology, we have a timeline. Today, standard Big Bang cosmology. And then there was a period of inflation, a period of finite duration, when the universe was expanding approximately exponentially. A of t will be the scale factor. So I'll make one more plot. Let me see. So more important than the timeline is going to be the space-time sketch. Time, space. We have a finite period of exponential expansion. And let me for now just plot the inverse Hubble expansion rate, the Hubble radius, which is constant during inflation, expands linearly after. Now, if you want to ask how do we get inflation, in all of our current models, we need scalar fields. So we have toy models for inflation based on keeping general relativity classical and adding scalar fields. Now, within this context, you can prove that there was a period before inflation started and that this period had a singularity. So now I can complete. So what I'm adding now is, under the assumption that classical general relativity is true and that you get inflation using scalar fields, then there's a singularity at the beginning. And so therefore, there's a region of breakdown of our theory. So that's the zone of ignorance. And obviously, one role of quantum gravity is to resolve this singularity. So, now, if we just look at this background, where does quantum gravity lie? Well, I would claim, firstly, that even to get inflation is a challenge right now for quantum gravity. Because you can construct toy models of inflation if you allow yourself to write down ad hoc scalar fields, couple them to general relativity. But if you ask, where do these toy models come in terms of particle physics, we don't really know. Even in string theory, where there are many scalar fields in the low energy effect of action, there are no, as if I'm not mistaken, there are no convincing models which are free of problems. So maybe inflation will come out of quantum gravity. So this singularity, which happens before inflation, might be hidden from observational detectability because inflation lasted a long time and the signals from down here were redshifted. But maybe the challenge for quantum gravity lies right here in terms of getting inflation in a different way. Now I'm going to try to keep this sketch here because I'm going to come back to it. So let me now make some provocative comments. So I claim that we don't need inflation for cosmology. There are other scenarios which we could try to develop. For example, bouncing cosmologies, and there'll be a third. So in bouncing cosmologies, the timeline would go from minus infinity to plus infinity. There'd be a point of minimal radius, which I will call t equals 0. And we would have an expanding phase and a contracting phase. Okay. So if we talk about bouncing cosmologies, then we are going away from the picture that we have a hot, small Big Bang, but we are going back to the pre-Big Bang theory of initial conditions that we start cold. If we start cold, then the typical length scale associated with a cold universe is a large length scale. So I would claim that in the context of bouncing cosmologies, a la pre-Big Bang, Gasparian Veneziano and Ek Parotic. And loop quantum cosmology. I would claim that in terms of these scenarios, the problems which we usually think of as inflation solving have a different light. So what about the size problem, the entropy problem, and the horizon problem? Why is the universe so large? Why does it contain so much entropy? And why was the surface that we see today in the microwave background in causal contact? Well, if the universe starts out large and cold, if it starts out at about our size or even larger, with about our conditions in the contracting phase, there is no size problem, there is no entropy problem, and the horizon problem is trivially solved. It remains a flatness problem. And even if we postulate that the universe at very early times was not too perturbed, then the overall spatial flatness is also not a problem. The only problem is the fluctuations. But I'm not yet there. I'll come to the fluctuations. So now, if we adopt a bouncing cosmology, then there is a region of quantum gravity, namely right here. We need quantum gravity to resolve a singularity. Now, if this scenario is realized, then the region of quantum gravity is not hidden from us through a period of exponential expansion. And there may be signatures which we would see today. So let me go back here. So the third possibility is emergent space-time. I'll be a little bit more modest, just emergent space. So here, the timeline, I will draw it as dashed or pointed. We have a phase of standard expanding cosmology. And here we have some other system, some quantum gravity model, which does not contain space in the usual way, which does not have the usual effective field theory interpretation. OK, so now in such an emergent space setup, some of the problems that are solved in the bouncing cosmology would reappear. Here, we would actually have to explain the size and the entropy of this initial phase. But what I want to illustrate is that this, again, here, in obtaining this transition, quantum gravity will play an important role. Now, if you have a phase of quantum gravity followed by a transition to a phase of usual space-time expansion, then condensed matter teaches us that in any such transition, you will have defects. And in a condensed matter phase transition, these defects are well known to be macroscopic. So if this kind of space-time picture is realized, we would actually expect that we would today see remnants on macroscopic scales.
Why do you say that space is immersion in these models?
Because I can think of having time immersion as well. What I'm thinking of concretely is, for example, is to mention a connection with string theory. The most radical version of matrix theory, where you have a large n quantum mechanical system in time, but time is there. Then you have a transition to a description where space appears from the eigenvalues of the matrices. So
So please feel free to extend this list. Just, I cannot do it, because I cannot think of tiny versions. That's my limitation. Okay. So.
So hopefully I've given you the idea that even at the background level, from understanding background cosmology, we should expect signatures of quantum gravity in observation. But now I want to go back. I want to turn to the issue of fluctuations. Most of the data concerns fluctuations. So let me first discuss fluctuations in the context of inflation. So today we observe fluctuations on very large scales. I'm going to draw two scales. What inflation does is it exponentially increases the physical wavelength of these fluctuations during the period of inflation and makes them smaller than the Hubble radius. That's what the success of inflation is based on. Inflation wants to make the scale of fluctuations we observe today sub-Hubble at the beginning. Now, there's another scale, which I'll draw in red. And this length you can call either the Planck length or the string length. That's a length scale below which we don't trust the description of physics. So there's another zone of ignorance. And now in inflationary cosmology, the situation is not as optimistic as I drew it here. So provided that the time period of inflation lasts more than 70 E-foldings, H now is the Hubble rate during inflation. Inflation needs to last at least 50 or so E-foldings in order for inflation to do its job. If it lasts more than 70 E-foldings, then all scales we observe today start out with a wavelength smaller than the Planck length. So when we do the predictions, when we calculate the predictions of inflation, we're actually calculating them using the wrong theory. So this is a trans-Planckian problem for fluctuations, which I guess Jens talked about, and we'll hear two more talks today. So let me blow up this sketch. No, not like this. Okay. So this is the Hubble radius. This is the Planck length. Now I'll draw my two scales. I'll expand the sketch downwards. So what I want to argue now is that there's a window for trans-Planckian physics that is wide open. Whether this window shows any interest in signals, that then depends on how the zone of ignorance is filled. So let me now imagine that the physics that describes this phase is non-adiabatic from the point of view of the wrong theory, which is ordinary scalar field theory coupled to gravity. By non-adiabatic, I mean, if we compare the evolution of a state in this phase and compare it with the evolution that we would calculate using quantum field theory and gravity, then you will find excitation of the occupation number. So that's what I mean by non-adiabatic. So What you see immediately is that if this is the case, then large wavelengths will be affected less than short wavelengths by this non-adiabatic evolution. And so therefore, any kind of violently non-adiabatic evolution on transplanting scales would predict deviations in the slope of the spectrum of microwave anisotropies. You will not predict the scale invariant spectrum anymore. You predict a red spectrum. Sorry, a blue spectrum. More power on small scales. So now you see, what I've done here is I've taken my time, my distinguished timeline. I've set initial conditions at a fixed time. And by doing this, I've broken the symmetry that is usually used to argue for scale invariance that Bill Press originally used before he even knew about inflation to argue that the de Sitter phase would produce a scale invariant spectrum of density perturbations. So I would say that there is, in inflationary cosmology, that when we are observing fluctuations now, we are actually probing things, probing scales which were transplanted. So we are doing Planck scale physics in cosmology today. So artificial toy models of Planck scale physics that predict violent non-adiabatic evolution are ruled out by observations, provided that inflation was right. Well, that's a big provider that I've snuck in and that I don't want you to believe. Okay. So, now, one comment I'd like to make is the following. If you imagine that there are two scales,
not going to be erased during the inflationary period.
Okay. Because, so I'm going to answer this question now in the context of general relativity topic tonight. The equation of motion for fluctuations is a wave equation, so linear fluctuations between them in Fourier space. You have a wave equation and some function of time. This is the equation that describes fluctuations. This has no damp determinant. Vk is a variable which describes fluctuations, which I'll come back to later. And all that's happening is redshift. So if you encode the signal on some microscopic scale here, this signal will not be diluted in amplitude. It will just be redshift.
But that doesn't take into account the normal decay of excited quantum.
It does. Because, well, but see, everything decays away if the universe expands. So what you have to calculate is relative.
No, I'm not talking about the decay because of expansion. I'm talking about the quantum decay. If I'm excited, the quantum stays
right
there.
Yep.
Move it to a higher patient number, and then that thing can decay.
So
quantum mechanically, I mean, no?
Yes, so I'm doing it. I'm assuming that quantum mechanics only sets initial conditions, and then I follow the evolution pattern. So quantum decay would add an extra term, but we don't. The usual calculations are not done this way. What I'm just saying is if you stick in some transplanting physics here and you treat the subsequent evolution as usual, as done in inflationary cosmology, you get a different relation. So I will certainly allow you to include, so maybe your quantum gravity theory will have a damping term here, and then that will produce an attractor that will attract you to the symmetric point. And I think that's one of the things that you alluded to in your talk, quantum mechanics work. Maybe that can be disciplined to see. Okay. So this equation now relates. Okay. Let me now go. Come to my bouncing cosmology. I now want to construct a space-time diagram for my bouncing cosmology. And here I will first have, I'll consider a bounce which is classically singular, which can only be quantum mechanically resolved. For example, the bounce in the pre-Big Bang model, the bounce in the ekpyrotic model, and also the bounce in deep quantum cosmology. So I'm drawing physical distance versus time. I'll draw the Hubble radius. And I will draw the scalar fluctuations. So, fluctuations also hit this transplanted window. So, in the case of a bounce in cosmology, in the case of a singular bounce, there's a direct transplanted problem, and problem should be a positive word, it means a way to probe functional physics. But let's now go on to the case where you have a non-singular bounce. Like you can achieve in various modifications of Brandon. For example, in the Quinton model or in some hybrid of Brandon gears. So then, what will happen is that the Hubble radius is never singular. The Hubble radius will do this. So the bounce point, H is zero, Hubble radius is infinite. And the fluctuations, they stay at finite rates. So this is a fixed k-mode. So if you have a non-singular bounce, then you would say first that there's no transplanted issue for fluctuations because the length scale of the fluctuations is always greater than the Planck. And to put some numbers here, if I assume that the energy scale which dictates the bounce is the scale of ground unification, if I take all of the radius back into the past, I find a length scale of 1 millimeter here. That's what I mean by being away from the region of increments. So there's no direct transplanted problem, but there's an indirect transplanted problem. And indirect comes about because the evolution of the fluctuations which we are observing depends on the background that we stick in. Maybe now it's a time to be a little more concrete. So if I take my metric, and I'll write this on a different board. So my metric that describes background and perturbations. So A is a scale factor of the background. Eta is conformal time. I introduce the metric fluctuation phi. That's a metric fluctuation which couples to matter. Then I have down the metric that contains cosmological perturbations and gravitational waves. C So if I, for now, look at the gravitational wave mode, I write it as amplitude times polarization tensor. And I write the amplitude of the gravitational wave as A inverse times U. Then U satisfies the following equation of motion. U double prime in momentum space. So the evolution of the gravitational waves is determined by the background. So this is what I mean by indirect Transplanckian problem. So if you compare two universes which are different scale factors, the fluctuations will evolve differently. And so this is a way that, given a background that you have for a particular quantum gravity model, you'll be able to calculate direct imprints in observations.
By solving this equation, and I will show an example.
This that generates the bounce. And at early times, we suppose gravity is more or less normal, and at late times as well. But I think it's still to focus on long wave amplitude. The dense gravity group is really constant.
Yeah, I'm sure. Obviously, the evolution at late times will be the same. But it's the evolution at the transition.
So, okay, I'm not so
sure. I mean, I'll show a concrete example.
I'm not sure about the tensor story, but I know for scalars, there are theorems that was shown by Light and Wand that as long as your whatever theory of gravity you have, as long as it's generally covariant, then your matter stress tensor is conserved, and you can show zeta is conserved on supervisor.
No, what actually happens is that zeta is not even a good variable in this context. Zeta, the equation of motion for zeta is simple. The gauge, which corresponds in which zeta has a physical meaning, that even goes up in a bouncing situation. So, obviously, if you have any such theory and you fix initial conditions here at late times, the evolution at late times will be the same. Mm-hmm. It's only where the scale factor is different. That's where you can have imprints. So, let's look at this 1 millimeter scale fluctuation. The point is that near the bounce region, since the scale factor is evolving very differently, you could in part imprint. Or maybe not. You have to ask for the concrete models. Okay. So I think this was things I wanted to say about the general issues. Let me just expand here a bit. I'll complete the story by also writing down the equation motion for the scalar fluctuations, the cosmological fluctuations. Here I wrote down the equation motion that describes the gravity waves. So now what I'm going to do is, for simplicity, I will take matter to be a scalar field, phi of x and t. And I'll write this as background plus fluctuation. Without matter, there's no phi. So now I can define the variable b, which is scale factor times delta phi plus phi naught prime over h phi. This triangle, where h is the scale factor, the Hubble rate is in conformal time. And it is this variable that describes, that evolves in a very nice way, according to the wave equation, which is almost identical to the previous one, a accept that it's not the scale factor that appears here in this term, but it's something that's related to the scale factor. This z, I think, is phi naught prime over h. So. So then, the background enters into the evolution of cosmological evolution.
This is in the slow world regime, right?
No.
Why not? No, it's still.
No. No slow world extinction. Because it's just the background. Good. So now I come to a particular example. So what I want to do now is to illustrate the previous fairly general statements using two examples. The first is, and both examples are somehow related to string theory. First is fluctuations from a tachyonic Big Bang, and secondly, fluctuations in string gases moment. So, here I'm going to talk about work that I've done in collaboration with Andrew Frey and Sigurdi Kanna, which is in June. Oops. So, what we decided to do is to take a model which looks like an emergent scenario. So we took our timeline to be the following. You have a tachyon phase leading straight into standard Big Bang cosmology. And this tachyon phase is described by a tachyon field, which has a potential, and the tachyon is rolling up the potential. That's what I'm sketching as the evolution of key of t. The potential locally near the maximum can be written as minus 1/2 m squared t squared. And the tachyonic phase ends with the tachyon sitting here. And this comes from a paper by McGreevy. And so was who investigated the possibility that in string theory, the singularity of the big crunch can be resolved via tachyon condensation. So the idea there is that space contracts at some minimal size, a condensate of closed spin tachyons develops, and this tachyon condensate starts to evolve down. So what we did is we turned around the timeline, and I'm aware that there's an instability issue, because I have to tune the initial tachyon velocity exactly right, such that I end up at rest up here. But anyway, so this timeline is exactly a time reversal of what McGreevy and Silverstein did. And the question we ask is, what is the spectrum of fluctuations? Cosmological fluctuations at t equals zero. Now, equation of motion for u for the gravitational waves turns out to be the following. D squared is t squared plus some coefficient . So if you have a tachyon in a programmed potential, it's going to have an exponential profile. This is the exponential profile. So what you find is that this tachyon constant, it induces a mass term which is tachyon dependent, which has this profile. This is the way that the gravitons are on. So what we will do is we will choose initial conditions, t going to minus infinity. We will start in the minimum energy state. And then we will solve this equation like you solve equations in quantum field theory curves of this type. Except that we said that the object is this time, here it's an object of tachyon. So it's like particle production in an external magnetic field. Here it's particle production in an external tachyon field. So after having done the calculation, you find a result that you can later argue is obvious. You go to imaginary time. You have a periodicity in imaginary time, which is given by beta, which is given by the tachyon mass. So if you have a periodicity in imaginary time, you get a thermal spectrum. And that's indeed what you get. So the result is you get a thermal spectrum for you. Not a bunch Davies vacuum, but you get a thermal spectrum. So now, what that implies for observations obviously depends on how you, whether you have standard Big Bang cosmology or whether you have inflation. So if the period that happens after the tachyon phase is inflation followed by usual cosmology, then you will find that instead of starting with a Bunch Davies vacuum, you will start with a thermal state with a particular length scale imprinted. And that then, if inflation lasts only a short amount of time, between 100 and 50 E foldings, that then you will see a remnant of this thermal wavelength in observations today. If the
No, it's not. I chose a minimal energy state. So it's if you we have this particular time frame. So in this frame, it's a state that's empty of particles. So we have in this frame, we're going to find a Hamiltonian. It's a state that minimizes this Hamiltonian.
And what's the temperature?
The temperature is set by the mass. So the mass gives you the tachyon evolution. The tachyon evolution gives you the temperature. So obviously, we expect this to be about Planck scale. So this is an example where, for a short period of inflation, you will get different predictions from standard Bunch Davies. However, there would also be other ways of getting the thermal initial spectrum. And my interest in this model comes more from the second application, which I have in mind, which is fluctuations in string gas cosmology. So let me
because so far So far, this could be, is an effective theory description, what you can describe. So but it could be, the tightness could be more general theory than strings, I guess. It could be.
That's right.
Okay.
So first of all, you see everything in my message, that there was nothing string specific, except in my examples. And obviously this example I took,
yes,
because right. I have someone else getting this tournament. And similarly here, I'll be, in the next application, I'll be doing something
strange. Yes, to the string, yes. But this would be valid in more general.
It could be more general.
More general, in fact, any instability.
Right. Yep, right. That's important to see.
I have a very quick question. You said that the, for a certain number of defaults, the will be able to see some relevance of it. But that depends presumably on the temperature. How do you know what the scale of the temperature
is? That's right. The only scale in the problem here is the string scale. So when I made the statement, I was assuming that M is given by the string scale. And then the statement is that if inflation lasts too long, then the string scale will have redshifted to way beyond any scale that we observe today. Then we'll be observing the Wien tail, and the spectrum in the Wien tail looks like the spectrum of the Dutch babies.
But then even in standard inflation, there's no constraint on
exactly.
the state at the
yes.
beginning of inflation, right. So there's no argument why at
yes.
the beginning of inflation
absolutely.
We would have a bunch of data.
In fact, in this example of short period of inflation, you should never assume that you have a bunch of data stacking. It's much more realistic to assume that you have an initial funding state.
Well, any state that is consistent
yep.
with inflation starting, but I don't think that.
Right. Right. So again, this. In the context of inflation, this is not such a useful prediction. But I'll come back to that very briefly after the next example. So the next example is string gas cosmology, and there...
Sorry, Robert, I have a super question. So your background somehow stays that the space line is that.
In the tachyon phase, yes.
That's at the effective theory level, is it because of some finding string firing?
This equation actually comes from the worksheet. Action for strings,
mm-hmm.
and those again strings in flat space time. Mm-hmm. See that the tachyon settles down. Yeah, that's a good question. So how do I make the transition from the tachyon phase? Well, in terms of the evolution of cosmological perturbations, it's clear the system just disappears, and I get the usual. So for fluctuations, this equation continues. How I get the background to continue bouncing around is I don't know.
Well, there is where the more microscopic theories
yep.
come in.
Yeah.
So, principle.
But your question about the background, I can answer in the second example. So the second example, I'm taking a scale factor which starts out static. I'll have a high temperature gas of strings in the hadron phase, and I'll have a transition to the radiation phase. This is a pressureless phase. This is pressure one third wave. So this background comes from string gas cosmology. If you have a box of strings with radius r, and you've got the temperature of this box, you don't have a divergence, but you have this following shape. The more entropy you have, the longer this flat region will be. So I'm going to consider a universe with a lot of entropy, where I have a long region of this behavior. So this is the hadron region. And the hadron region
to be able to know space, and I have a box of strings. And this R, this box includes oscillatory loops, it includes motion, centered mass motion, it includes winding, strength of winding. At very high energies, you dump energy into the winding modes, into the momentum modes, and into the oscillatory modes. Momentum modes have negative pressure, winding modes have negative pressure, momentum modes have positive pressure. If you have equal number of winding modes and momentum modes, you get pressure equals zero. The symmetries of underlying string theory tell me that we should expect this Hadamard phase to be static. So I'll be postulating this background. And in this background, I'll now be evolving the spectrum of cosmological perturbations using this equation and the equation for gravity waves.
This is supposed to be after the end of inflation, I suppose.
No, this is
before.
There's no inflation.
There's no inflation, okay.
So,
this is occurring in how many dimensions now? Or is it an effective thing? 3 plus 1.
6 are wrapped by winding strings forever and will remain small.
And are static, they are not participating in the dynamics.
Okay, that's fine. So now I'll plot the evolution of space time diagram.
And when you say there's no inflation, this is in this example. Wait a minute.
Because where do the fluctuations come? Where does the scaling bands come? That's the next, that's what I'm doing. The Hubble radius does this. Usually the expansion in the Friedman phase, but static, Hubble radius infinite. So this is what the Hubble radius is. Now, the length scale of fluctuations does the following. Universe is okay, so this early phase is a phase of thermal equilibrium of strings. So here we have string thermodynamic fluctuation.
So what happens? How do you leave the static phase?
Okay, the way we leave the static phase is by this process. Two winding modes turning into loops. This is, loops is radiation. So this is a process that only allows three dimensions to grow, because this process only happens in three plus one dimensions. This is how you get from P equals zero to P equals zero further. It's a smooth transition. So this was Gazal's question for the other model, which I couldn't answer for the other model, but here I can answer. So this is a okay, so now I'm running fairly late in time, so I'll just tell you the results of the calculation. So instead of doing particle thermodynamics, you do string thermodynamics. The energy density fluctuations determine phi. The off-diagonal pressure perturbations determine h. So string thermodynamics tells us the delta T 0, 0 and delta T R J in this space. Then what we do is we fix a scale k, and at the time that this scale exits the Hubble radius, we determine phi and we determine h. This is effectively the Poisson equation, 0, 0 Einstein equation, ij, I multiply to j Einstein.
So to do that, you need to simulate this transition between V0 and V.
No.
Or how do you know how the power radius is there? It's supposed to be infinite. So
it's the Hubble radius here, the radius is different. I just need to model this decrease.
Okay. Okay.
I'll have it fairly abrupt, like in this picture.
But wouldn't the precise details of that leave an imprint of how you...
Yes, it does. And let me give you the result. So you asked for a little more detail than I was going to give. But the result is that the power spectrum of the metric variations is L Planck divided by L string to the fourth power times 1 divided by 1 minus T the I of K divided by T H. So this is the temperature of the string S at the time that the scale S is not ready. So that's the result. Now, you see, if the transition occurs very rapidly, this temperature will be independent of K, and we get a completely scale-invariant spectrum of perturbations. This is why I don't need inflation. I have a scale-invariant spectrum of perturbations. For experts, I'll just mention that the perturbations are propagating on supernormal scales, therefore they get squeezed, therefore you have the acoustic oscillations. Now, if you take the temperature, if you look at larger Ks, as the T decreases slightly, so you get a small red curve. Light inflation. But now you calculate the power spectrum of gravitational waves. And what you get is a scaling down piece and a loop. Which you can't reproduce using inflation with canonical terms.
And this is consistent with all the findings of the CMB as WMAP and all that.
Remember how hard it is to get the amplitude right for inflation? Look up in Green, Schwarz, and Witten, take their length, their value for the string length, take this value of the order unity, and you get copy normalization.
And you don't need reheating because you have the temperature from the collision. Yeah, you have the temperature.
That
you have the collisions of
the
loops.
Yeah. Okay, so blue curve. This is an imprint of string physics. Okay. So again, I just want to repeat the statement that I think we can already be doing experimental quantum gravity in an observatory. Finally, just a few words about detecting cosmic strings, cosmic superstrings in the cosmic microwave background. So there'd be, the universe has to be large in this Hadron phase because we want to reproduce a large universe. If the universe is large at the Hadron temperature, there'll be remnant cosmic superstrings forever, even today. So these superstrings would impact the cosmic microwave sky like cosmic strings. And what cosmic strings do is they provide a line of continuity in the cosmic microwave background. So I'm now talking about a paper which I did wrote with two undergraduates, Stephen Amsel, Joshua Berger, myself, I think it's September. So if you have a cosmic superstring, which is pointing this way, then space perpendicular to this cosmic superstring has a deficit angle. It's like a cone. Now, if the string is moving in this direction, you are here, looking at the cosmic microwave background coming to us, then because of this deficit angle, you'll have a real Doppler shift, whose amplitude is given by this angle, which is 4 pi g mu. Mu is the tension of the string. So, you have a piece of the sky, and in this piece of the sky you will see lines across which
the temperature jumps. So temperature is slightly higher here.
It is slightly lower here. So if you take a cross section in this direction, z direction, then the temperature will look, make a jump.
Which one is cooler? I mean, the string arrangement seems to be very symmetric from one side to the other. Why would one side become cooler?
Also,
this is the string is moving across the sky.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's a motion. It's a real life. So, if you go more than a Hubble distance away from the string, the depth of angle disappears. So this is the profile of temperature we have in this direction. So now what you can do is you can actually try to develop an algorithm to look for these cosmic strings in the sky. And what you don't want to do is you don't want to expand these Kalman harmonics
and take the power spectrum, because you lose this distinctive features in position space. So what you really want is an edge detection algorithm.
Does it have to be extremes?
No. So far they are cosmic strings.
They are cosmic strings.
So you use an edge detection algorithm. And this algorithm, the algorithm which we've explored, is called the Kalman algorithm. So, unfortunately, I don't have time to explain. I'd be happy to explain to you in private what the algorithm is. But
we found that the sensitivity of this algorithm, it should be able to see strings if g mu is smaller than about 4 times, if larger than 4 times 10 to the minus 8, about one order of magnitude better limit than with conventional techniques. That's if you have an angular resolution of about 10 arc minutes, which is good enough for Planck and good enough for the South Pole telescopes. Smaller angular resolution, you can do even better. So you don't need this portion of the sky to be very large. 5 degrees by 5 degrees is sufficient. So you don't need a full sky survey. Obviously, if you have a full sky survey, you get better statistics. Angular resolution is important. So now, finally, how could you distinguish between a cosmic superstring and a cosmic string? And I'll just say that in words. For cosmic superstrings, you can have junctions. You can have bound states between D strings and fundamental strings called PQ strings. And so you can have something that it is hard to construct in simple field theory models. Namely, you could have an object like this. Strings coming together, quantum numbers being preserved. You can show, this is a paper I've recently written with Joanna Karubi and Hassan Firujawi, that if you take a static junction, the metric is the same as the metric for cosmic string. It's again conical. So my proposal is, if you really want to find signatures for cosmic superstrings in the sky, as opposed to just cosmic strings, you look for junctions. So what you have to do,
conical in each segment, or?
Yep, each segment. So you have your sky map.
And then you have the Kani algorithm. And this Kani algorithm produces an edge map. And an edge is a line in the sky where the temperature jumps sufficiently. So the sky map goes into the edge map. And then what we did to just identify plain cosmic strings we looked at the histogram of edge lengths. This was enough to give us this result. So in order to identify cosmic superstrings in the sky, you'd have to change this. You'd have to come up with do the same Carney algorithm, produce the edge map, and then you'd have to have a junction identifier. And this is one of the things I'm currently working on. Okay, so I'd like to wrap up. I hope to have persuaded you that we can do quantum gravity, maybe not in the laboratory, but in observations. And this is not futuristic, but we can do it now. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I would prefer the cosmic superstrings rather than the cosmic strings in view of the role in planet unification and other parts of physics. You know, I mean, because if it is a non-supersymmetric cosmic string, as you know, probably this is probably their density is very much suppressed or whatever. Otherwise, you would run in some planet unification for now. So most likely it would be superstrings if there. Yeah. And what are the prospects of, you know, what is their density that you come across?
Okay, so this result is based on the standard scaling solution, where you assume that the only one string for Hubble Earth radius at each time. Now, if you have, so I should have mentioned that that's an assumption, if the density is smaller than that, the bound gets smaller.
The standard scaling solution is more than 30 for Hubble 1.
Or did we use 10? Yeah. Okay.
So the string gas has no one particularly described. There are some criticisms to it. So what are they and why are they wrong?
So obviously I'm not doing string gas cosmology justice because I only spoke for maybe 15 minutes about it. I drew this nice picture here, the nice timeline. Where does this come from? We can't give an effective field theory, a convincing effective field theory that will give us this time evolution. I hoped that dilaton gravity would do the trick because of dilaton singularity. Now the criticism effectively is that if you try to use dilaton gravity, it will not work. But we have a paper pointing that out too. So that's the main point of the criticism. There's also another. There are also two more technical criticisms which I strongly disagree with.
So that was my standard question. So can you make a comment about the symmetry in the fundamental theory? I have this picture you've drawn up here where you see the Planck length down the side. You said there's trans-Planck in problem because it flows from below the Planck length. So in what plane do you think? Is it posited on there being some special plane? Can you just say, well, it's a cosmological plane and make some argument that there's no fundamental symmetry breaking in quantum gravity? Or can you give some comment on that?
All of my considerations use a particular frame, namely the cosmological frame.
Yeah.
So I'm using the frame of the microwave background today.
Yeah.
And
does that?
But see, this is a frame in which inflation is postulated.
Yeah. But in order to draw this pink thing down the side of the board, does that mean that? That frame comes into quantum gravity somehow.
In this cosmological scenario, this singles out the frame. In this frame, there's only a big difference between this frame.
Okay.
In a different frame, you look different.
For the superstring junction, you said something went wrong if the junction was moving. Now, if I just go to the rest frame of the junction and do the calculation there, or...?
I just told you that we've verified explicitly
that for a static ship, see, if you have a open string with an end, you won't find a flat measure.
Okay.
Now, if you don't have a static string, what I mean by that is that there's some acceleration, which means it looks more like an open string than a closed string. So if it's just moving, sure, it's just moving, there's no problem.
Okay.
But if it's accelerating,
very nice, but I still haven't understood this picture.
Yes,
that what happens if I look at that again from the restraint of the string? In other words, it seems to me if I move to the restraint of the string, I still will see a wall in the background emitting at a constant temperature. There will be redshifts, they will be equal because I'm symmetric in the frame, and then I boost back to my frame and I can see where the symmetry comes from.
Okay, so you want me to be in a frame in which the strings are pressed?
Yes.
So I am moving in this frame. And now, this photon arrives with an angle relative to this photon. So that is a dot. So it's this angle difference which comes from the wedge, which gives the dot.
Just a quick one. What happens if you consider a scenario in which the string also goes to the bulk dimension? So it's not
that.
That
I can answer. I haven't considered.
Because it could be, eh? It could be a case.
Yes.
Strings, I guess.
Right. Unknowns.
Okay. Yeah.
All of my calculations assume that you have three large ones. Sure. The other ones are strings. That would be interesting to think of. By the way, I should apologize. I have to step for about 2 days.